Well, I want to say hello to everyone and welcome back to most of you. We have been looking last week at 1 Corinthians 13, a chapter that focuses on love, and on in that chapter, starting at verse 4 and going through verse 7, there's a list of characteristics of love. I've rewritten on the board at least a summary point for each of these that we looked at last week. And what I want to do today is to start the process of coming back into this list and looking at events that happened in the life of Jesus that allow us to see the characteristic of love worked out in his life in these ways. And I'll put a few more things with this as we go along. So, we have 15 or 16 of these. The first five, love is long-suffering, it is kind, it is never envious or jealous, never boastful or bragging, never arrogant. And it goes on from there. And what we're going to do this morning is work on these first five. And we'll come back next time and work a little bit further. And so, if you will, in order for us to see something about this, if you would find the book of Luke and look at chapter 9. And I want you to start at verse 51. And a long time ago, my English teachers taught me that if I used two F's in succession after a verse like that, that meant "and following." I don't know why it's not AF. I don't know why it's FF, but it's probably Latin somewhere. But in any event, that's where they were. Okay? So, starting at verse 51, it happened that as the time drew near for him to be, my translation says, taken up, and there's a footnote that says, y'all come on in, there's a place right up here. You won't bother me at all. It happened as the time drew near for him to be taken up, and my footnote says what that means is for the ending events of his life, for his arrest, for his trial and crucifixion and resurrection. As that time drew nearer, he resolutely turned his face toward Jerusalem and sent messengers ahead of him. These set out, and they went into a Samaritan village to make preparations for him. But the people of that village would not receive him because he was on his way to Jerusalem. Now, I want to make sure that the context is clear. This is one of those things that if you've been in church and you've been in Sunday school for a while, you're likely to know this. But just in case there's somebody who doesn't. What was the attitude of Jewish people towards the people of Samaria in these days? There was a hatred or a looking down on. Okay? Why? Because Samaria was the land that occupied the place in geography of the northern kingdom back when the kingdom of Israel divided after David and after Solomon. 10 of the tribes were in the northern kingdom, 2 of the tribes were in the southern kingdom. And Samaria was now what was left of that after it was conquered by Assyria, after everybody was taken out into exile. The remnants that were left populated this region called Samaria. And so the Jewish people saw themselves as pure and saw the Samaritans as half-breeds at best and therefore looked down on them. Now, if you happen to be Samaritan, what might your attitude be towards Jewish people? You might respond in kind. You might have the level of contempt for them that you perceived that they had for you. And so, it says the people of that village, this is verse 53, would not receive him, that is, would not allow his messengers to prepare for him to maybe spend a night or something like that there, because he was on his way to Jerusalem. There was a part of the kingdom of the Jewish people. There was a part of their land at the north and a part of their land at the south, with Jerusalem in the southern part. So Jesus is up in Galilee. He's on his way. And one way, a lot of people would cross the Jordan River, go south cross the Jordan River again and then come back up to Jerusalem that way. And Jesus was trying to go straight through. They said, you're on your way to Jerusalem. We're not going to let you go through here. We're not going to let you have hospitality here. Right? Verse 54, read the verse. Don't go past verse 54. Just read the verse and tell me what was the suggestion of the messengers.
Retaliation
at a very high level. What were they calling for? Fire from heaven, which amounts to basically a meteor strike. Let's just have a little crater, a smoking crater where that village used to be. That'll teach them. Okay? Have you seen the pictures from the tornadoes? Have you seen the few pictures that are beginning to come out of Burma, out of Myanmar, after the devastation? Wind itself is bad enough. Fire is worse. Meteors are worse yet. Fire from heaven. This isn't just a firestorm like they've had in California. This is smoking craters. What did Jesus do? I want the verbs. My translation says he turned and he then did something. What's the verb?
Rebuke.
Okay, so this is going to be our scratch pad over here. He rebukes them. And what does it say? Mine has a comma, verse 56. And they went on to another village. All right? Now what I'd like to do is I'd like to put this together for you. Time out. Let's make sure that we're oriented. Which characteristic of love in action are we looking at? Long suffering. Right? Or suffering long. Long suffering. Right?
Hey, Bill.
Yeah.
I've got more between my verse 55 and 56.
I know. There's a few who do.
Okay.
I've got a little.
Went to a village.
Yeah. There's a little commentary. This is added in some translations, but it's not in the oldest translations. Mine has that footnote, too. We can come back and read that a little later and see if it still fits the context, but we're going to pick up enough just from this.
Okay.
All right. So, he rebuked them.
Rebuked who?
James and John, who must have been either in contact with the messengers he had sent or had been the messengers reporting back. You won't believe what they did down there. Smoking crater time. All right. Here's my question. What do you do when you rebuke someone?
Read them the riot act. Read them. That's the way I would have said it. Read them the riot act. Okay.
What else? Because I do not think you have it yet. That's part of it. I do not believe that's all of it.
Reorient.
Yeah, take them down.
Speak truth.
I think that's out of topic one and that's out of topic two. What else? Somebody was saying something.
It's almost like you're saying you don't want to be a part of that. You know, I'm choosing not to be a part of that sort of thinking. That.
Express disagreement or disappointment with, which is still sort of a topic one. You'll see what I mean by topic one and topic two in just a second.
This is a good time to bring out another herb.
Yeah. People call that a teaching moment. Right? Or a teachable moment. Teachable assumes that you've actually got some response from the person you're talking to. Teaching moment says you're going to try to see if you have a response. Okay. What does rebuke mean? Does rebuke mean you tell them everything they did wrong? Or you try to explain to them why it's wrong? Do you just tell them it's wrong, or do you try to help them understand why it's wrong? I think it's the latter a little bit. Now, I will admit, when I hear that word, it's harsh. This is not friendly and nice and sort of hearts and rainbows kind of stuff. This is taking to the woodshed or Read them the Riot Act. But
buried in that is an explanation of what's wrong, and I like that way of wording it, a sense of trying to help them understand what a better way would have been.
Maybe. Maybe. And our dad, I don't know that that necessarily pulls all these pieces in, but maybe.
How about a sharing of your expectations? If you're reviewing someone doing something wrong, stop them where they are. Let them know that what they're doing is wrong, and your expectations of where it is you think you need to be
taught. An expression of expectations. Yeah, what did Jesus do?
When he finished rebuking them, mine has a comma, and yes, I don't have that little section in there, but after the comma, I've got something in the footnote that sort of puts that other stuff in. So skip that little inserted part. After the comma, the last little bit of the verse, what did he do? Went to another village, right? Yes, ma'am.
In doing so, didn't he demonstrate with his actions?
That's what I want you to say. Yeah. Yeah.
Exactly what he wanted us to do. He lived it.
Uh-huh. And what else did he do? There's no smoking crater. All those people are still there. They have a chance to learn what he was able to do in a place that accepted him as an example for the place that didn't. In the hopes that maybe the day would come that the first village might respond.
And isn't that exactly what Travis talked about in fourth bullet point today?
Mm-hmm. Sort of seemed like it to me as I heard it. Now, I would normally chase this rabbit another minute or two and then move on to something else. But something happened in the first hour that I have to share with you. You're hearing this secondhand. But in the first hour, we heard it firsthand. Any of you know Bob Wilbur?
Yeah.
You know him? Among other things, what has a central place in his heart?
Prison
ministry. He talked about recently, there was a choir that came to our church. And I'm trying to think where the choir came from, but I think Tilly Fairchild had a daughter in the choir, Sanford University, Birmingham. And I didn't know this story. I knew when they had come because Tilly's in the first hour and we've heard all about the choir coming. Apparently, weeks ahead of time, messengers were sent ahead of him. Weeks ahead of time, they had sent people into the prisons at the prison at Buckingham to say, a college choir is here. They'd like to come and sing. And the people at Buckingham Prison said, they can't come. Said, we might allow part of the choir in here, but you're going to have to divide them in half. That's just too many people. So they made arrangements for half the choir to go to Dillon and half the choir to go to Buckingham. But they were concerned about what was going to happen when they got to Buckingham. And sure enough, they got to Buckingham and they were turned away. I know we said we'd do this, but we just don't have enough people here. We can't do it. So they put the choirs back together and went to Dillon, understanding that probably only half of them will get in. The people at Dillon said, you know, just bring them all in. We'll make it work. And they're waiting now for word to get back to Buckingham about what happened. Smoking craters. Or take the next step. Go where the open doors allow you. And let the word get back about what good things could come. This list is coming out of T.W. Hunt's work. And with each item on the list, he's put a scripture reference for a place in Jesus' life where this get worked out. And next to that, he's put a word that talks about love applied to a particular aspect of life. Love applied to a particular aspect of life. And the word he put up for this one was relationships. Love functioning in relationships is long-suffering. Rejects the idea of smoking craters. Instead, looks for opportunities to take advantage where love is welcomed. And maybe to set an example for the other places that in time they could respond. The nature of relationships. I found that story fascinating. It's about as pretty a lineup with what Scripture talks about as I had heard. What's the second one? Love is kind. We're going to go this time to Mark. Mark chapter 6. Now I have to admit as we do this, this one is a little less straightforward. You have to work a little harder on this one. It may not be quite as nice and clear as the first one, but I think there's gold here to be mined if we can find it. Mark chapter 6. I want you to take a look between verse 30 and verse 44 of Mark chapter 6. Especially take a look at verse 37 and 38. What's this the story of? Feeding of the 5,000. One little boy has two loaves and a few fish, and with that 5,000 men, it says, not to count all the women and the children, got enough to eat, and they collected 12 baskets full of what left over. All this has just happened, and we come to verse 45. Everybody ready? Verse 45. He made his disciples get into the boat and go on ahead to the other side near Bethsaida. In a few moments, we're going to be looking at another Bible story where it talks about Bethesda. This is a different place, Bethsaida. While he himself sent the crowd away. After saying goodbye to them, he went off into the hills to pray. Verse 47, when evening came, the boat was far out on the sea, and he was alone on the land, mine says. Verse 48, here's our focus, the beginning of our focus. He could see that they were hard pressed in their rowing, for the wind was against them. You ever go boating? I have been on sailboats a few times, but most of my time on the water, which isn't necessarily greatly expanded, but most of my time on the water has been spent in canoes. And a few times I've found myself in this position. Because when you're in a canoe and you're as big as I am, it's sort of like having a sail. If the wind is against you, the boat's going to probably go back and you're going to have to work pretty hard just to stay in the one place. That's an unfortunate truth. Okay? He could see that they were hard-pressed in their rowing. It looks like they weren't sailing. It looks like they were rowing. Why wouldn't they be sailing? Might have even had no wind, or the wind would be in the wrong direction, or the wind was a little too high. Or some combination of that, right? He could see that they were hard-pressed in their rowing. About the fourth watch of the night, what did he do? He went to them. Now, let's get this straight. They're out on the lake. He's on the shore. He's going to go to them. How's he going to get to them? He walks on the water. Most of the time when we get to this part, that's what you focus on. I don't want you to focus on there today. I'd like you to focus on this. Why did he go where he went? He was concerned about his disciples. He saw that they were hard-pressed. So here's a picture. Jesus sees his disciples in trouble, and he goes to get a closer look. What time of night was it? Fourth watch. Any idea when that is? Okay. Still pretty dark, probably. All right. And my translation, now you may have a footnote in here as well. My translation says, he was going to pass them by, and then the first word of the next verse, but. One translation said, he made as if to pass them by. That implies motive that most translations don't put in. Okay. Now, what picture emerges so far? The picture I would suggest is this. Jesus has gone to a private place to pray. He sent his disciples on out ahead of him and said, I'll catch up with you. And he sees them in trouble. He goes to them, middle of the night, to check on them, finds out, okay, they're in trouble, but they're probably okay. He makes them pass on by. And then they see him. How many people would have been awake in the fourth watch of the night? Probably a couple of them, the rest of them asleep, trying to get their energy so they can take turns with this, right? How many of them saw him?
Read it. They all saw it. Why? Because the first three screamed, and maybe because nobody was getting any sleep because they're all out there rowing trying to make headway against this wind. But they all seem, they think they're seeing a ghost. They all are terrified, and at that point he says, okay, fine, I'll get in the boat with you. And he gets in the boat, and the headwind drops and everything beyond it. But here's what I want you to see. Jesus sees his disciples in trouble. He goes to check close up to make sure everything's okay. Sees that, you know, it's hard time for them, but they're probably going to be okay. But then something else happens that frightens them to death, and he gets in the boat with them. T.W. Hunt says, this is an act of kindness. His concern for his disciples, his concern for his disciples, makes him want to find out for sure that they're okay. And to be close by in case they're not. What are his words to them? At once he spoke to them and said, courage, or take courage, meaning do not be afraid. That phrase in the Old Testament, the inverse of that, the phrase do not be afraid, is a constant one. Okay. Now, why would he do this? Why would he be concerned about his disciples? N.W. Hunt puts a very strange word out here.
The verse is down. This is Mark 6:48-50, I think is where he says.
He puts a very strange word out here. He puts the word purposes.
What's the connection between kindness and purposes?
One is utilitarian. He's kind to his disciples because he's looking for the disciples to be productive. And this is a way of producing that. One thing is, he said to his disciples at one point, I'm not going to call you my servants anymore. I'm going to call you my friends. Because I've shown you what I'm trying to do. I've brought you into this. Common purpose, I think, is better than Jesus has a purpose and he's going to work it out in them. I think it's rather the common purpose. And the function of love expressed in kindness is the one that I think serves as the sort of... Well, let's see if you can get the right word. When you have an engine and you got a whole bunch of parts that all have to function together, what have you probably better do to all those parts to keep them functioning together? Lubricate. Kindness becomes part of the lubrication that allows all the purposes to go. As I say, this one's a little bit harder than some of the others, but I think there's something in here. Kindness. You care about somebody, you check up, see if they're okay. If they're okay, fine, let them go a little further. But you still stay close by and make sure things are all right. Let's move to the next one. Never envious. Go back to Luke. You found Luke 9. Find it again.
Verse 57, verse 58.
Now, we're right back where we were. They've just been to these villages. They've done whatever they've done. They're still on their way to Jerusalem. And along the road, they meet a man on the road who says to Jesus, I'll follow you anywhere you go. And Jesus makes a very strange answer. What's his answer? He talks about foxes and birds. What does he say about foxes? They've got dens, we might call them. They've got holes in the ground where they can take shelter. And birds of the air have... We have outside of our house some lights. And the lights are covered by a globe of glass. There's a bird's nest perched right on top of the globe of glass. Now, if you put a bird's nest on top of a globe of glass, what's it liable to do? Slide off. This thing, it's like it has hair down the thing like this. It sort of anchors it all in place. I don't know what that bird thinks when the lights go on. But Jesus says foxes have dens, birds have nests. And then he talks about himself. And what does he say? I don't even have a place to lay my head.
I don't have any material possession. So what's the message to the young man? What did the young man say? Well, he doesn't say young man. What does the man say? I'm ready to follow you anywhere you go. What's Jesus doing? He's basically asking a question.
Have you gotten caught up in the material possessions that the world offers to the point that you can't live without them? What are your priorities? One of the things that's characteristic of love is that what is happening with people becomes more important than what's happening with things. The idea of envy is, I want the things more than I want interactions with people. And 1 Corinthians 13 says, love never goes there. So the idea of envy or jealousy, I want things more than I want to have things go well with people, not part of it. So the idea here is, in P.W. Hunt's words, what's the nature of your heart? We're talking here about priorities, values, those kinds of things. Questions or comments so far? Next one talks about boastful or bragging. Go to John chapter 5. And I'm writing it that way so that you know I'm deliberately not giving you the verse yet. Don't worry too much about that. John chapter 5. Look at the front end of John chapter 5. There's a story that happens in there between verse 1 and verse 18. Can you skim real quickly and tell me what that section talks about? Some of you will have seen this before. There's a man who is paralyzed, cannot function or walk. And there is a pool. This is the pool of Bethesda. And there's a belief that if the water is stirred, maybe there was a spring, maybe there would be air that would come up through the spring or some change in flow rate and it would stir the water. Whoever was the first one to get in the water, the belief was that person would be healed. Jesus sees this man who's been coming to that pool every day for 38 years and he says, do you want to walk? Do you want to be healed? And the man's response is, how can I be? I have nobody to help me be the first one to get into the pool. Jesus gives him instructions. This is verse 8. What's his first instruction? Get up. What's his second instruction? Pick up your sleeping mat. What's your third instruction? Walk around. What's the sleeping mat been doing for him? What's the function that the sleeping mat has provided for him? Cushioning has. He's been laying there for 38 years. So if he gets up and picks up the sleeping mat, symbolically, what's he saying? I don't need this on the floor anymore. Walk around demonstrates that he's been healed. The man was cured at once. What did he do? Doesn't say that he was getting up. A lot of people think he was cured as he attempted to get up. A lot of people think as he attempted to get up, he found that he was able to get up. So he picked up his mat. And he started to walk around. Why did he do that? Because Jesus told him to. Jesus told him to get up, pick up your mat, walk around. He found he could get up. So he's going to do what Jesus said. Verse 10, what day was it? Sabbath. What is forbidden on the Sabbath day?
Work.
What does picking up your mat and walking around while you're carrying it constitute? What did he just do? He just violated the Sabbath. What does that do? Calls down the scorn and criticism of the Jewish leaders. And, of course, the Jewish leaders' aim of that scorn would actually be Jesus, not the man. There are some things that happen in here. Who is the man who said to you, pick up your mat and walk around? The man had no idea who it was since Jesus had disappeared and the place was crowded. A little bit later, Jesus appears to him. He goes back and tells them in verse 18, all these things only made the Jewish leaders more intent on killing him because not only was he breaking the Sabbath. Now,
it was the man who broke the Sabbath first. Now you can almost hear the accusation switch to Jesus is breaking the Sabbath by doing healing on that day. But not only that, but Jesus spoke of God as his own Father and even more, made God his equal. Verse 19, Jesus begins to reply. Now there's two places where I want you to look for this reply. And before I go here, let me stop. I've got the context set now. Let's go back. What characteristic of love are we about to talk about? Not boastful or arrogant. You got that? Look at verse 19. What did Jesus say? In all truth I tell you, by himself the Son can do nothing. He can only do what he sees the Father doing. Whatever the Father does, the Son does it too. Come down to verse 30. What does it say? Almost the same thing. By myself, I can do nothing. And now he switches modes, not talking so much about actions as judgment. I can judge only as I am told to judge, but my judging is just, because I seek not to do my own will, but the will of the one who sent me.
So we got verse 19, we got verse 30.
Okay. What does he say? He is not taking the credit for himself. He's saying, I'm simply doing what the Father has taught me to do, what the Father has instructed me to do, in the way that the Father told me. Now, it's kind of neat to see a piece of this that's in here. If you go back to verse 17. Verse 16 says, it was because he did things like this on the Sabbath that the Jewish leaders began to harass him. Verse 17, Jesus' answer to them was, my Father never quits working. So I am at work too. Why are you working on the Sabbath day? My Father doesn't quit working on the Sabbath day. I keep working too. And that's a challenge that the Jewish leaders had trouble with. Now, what word would be an appropriate word to put here? This may be the clearest of the ones that we look at. What does love, and I think maybe it's time to talk about it, purifies or makes holy. Love purifies or makes holy these things. What is it that love purifies or makes holy that's revealed in this one? Boasting or bragging? God. Not so much the motive, but the words. He's under trying to say the best word he can think of to put out there is speech. What we say is purified or made holy if we have God's love working effectively. What we say can be purified or made holy if it emerges from the love that God has put in us and the love that God has shown to us. Got one more. Mark chapter 10. Mark chapter 10.
What does half-ass mean?
And the following. So we're going to start at verse 35. Okay. Remember James and John from a while back? They're back. What do they want this time? Verse 35, Master, we want you to do us a favor. What favor is that? Jesus says. And they said to him, what? We want to be the second and third in command in your kingdom. When your kingdom comes, we want one to sit on the right and one to sit on the left. We want to be the second and third in command. Jesus says, you have no idea what you're asking. The commentary goes on for a little while. He finally sets them aside. Verse 41, when the other ten heard this, what was their response? Oh, that's just James and John. We don't worry about that. No. What's the verb?
Indignant.
They were indignant. That's an adjective, isn't it? Or adverb. It's not a verb. Sorry. They began to feel indignant. What does the word indignant mean? Somewhere beyond mad. Mad enough to do something about it. Jesus called all of them together and he says something important. What does he say?
Be
You know that among the people, those that they call their rulers, my translation says, lord it over them, and their great men make their authority felt. Among you, this must not happen. Those who would be greatest in my kingdom must be what? Servants. Servants.
The word P.W. Hunt puts up here is, never arrogant has a parallel in service. The love that God has shown to us when it begins to come out in action purifies or makes holy our service. I had a fascinating experience about 2 years ago. We were about to start a job search, and we were looking for someone who would come into a support position. What is a support position? What does that phrase mean? She said subordinate, not quite. Support. You're talking about height. They're helping someone else who takes the lead. So I made the statement in a room of about 20 people that I'm supposedly supervising. I said, you know, I think as we look for this person, we need to find someone who has a servant mentality. You would have thought I dropped a stink bomb on them. It caught me completely off guard. Anger came out. How dare you, they said, suggest that someone who would be working in our group would be a servant. How dare you suggest that? Turns out the fellow we hired has a pretty good attitude by that score. I don't call it that anymore because it brings up that. We live in a world where people do not want to be seen as serving others. The world does not value that. People still do it, and it's amazing when they do. And it's praiseworthy when they do. But the world doesn't. When the world places its highest value on something, it's seldom that. It's seldom that. What does the world place high value on? Arrogance. And I thought it was very interesting that the idea of never arrogant in T.W. Hunt's mind translates into a purifying or a making holy of the service that we did. What emerges out of this so far? When God's love comes alive inside of me, some changes take place. And those changes could be summarized as a purification or a making holy of the relationships that I have, of the heart that I have, the way I value things, the priorities I have, the service that I render, and other things. And as we go through, that's what I'm trying to get you to see is how that list on the one side, so simply put together in four quick verses, translates into a much larger picture of the effect that God's love in action in my heart can begin to have on how I look at life, and how together in community we can encourage each other and help each other in these directions. Now, that's as much time as we have for today. Let's have a word of prayer as we finish. Our Father, we thank you that you love us. We thank you that your love is without condition, and that you love us even before you have made us lovable or lovely. We do thank you for the work that you do inside of us. We thank you for the community that you've placed us in. We thank you for the opportunities you put before us to begin to take the love that you've given us and pass it on to others, to let us take a look at what you're doing and how you see things and begin to do those things and begin to see things that way ourselves. Help us always remember that we're in community with each other, to encourage each other, to admonish each other, and to strengthen each other with the love that you've given us. Bless this study of ours that we may begin to understand better the love you have for us and what you want that love to accomplish in our lives. We pray all this in your Son's name. Amen.